Okay, we began our discussion, first section of 1 Peter chapter 5 last week, by pointing out the text is dealing with the office of elder, as the admonition by the apostle is given there. In other words, the term elder can be a generic term, but there are certain times when it is referring to a specific work that God has given in the church, and this is an example of that. We know that because he indicates the work as being that of shepherding and also as oversight in verse 2 of the text. And those actually all three terms that are commonly translated are commonly given we translate in English. Overseer or bishop, pastor or shepherd, and then elder are used in that first and second verses of that text there in 1 Peter 5. So these are the three designations given for that singular office of elder. It's kind of an interesting thing. We commonly use the term elder in the church. Probably because of the misuse of the other two terms. The term bishop is, for example, in the Catholic Church especially, but some of the other denominations, a term that is used to indicate hierarchical structure and authority, where you might have some individuals on an individual level, a higher level of organization or government in their denomination. Those individuals are referred to as bishops. So it's kind of an elevated thing, distinguishing this individual as above another. With regard to the term pastor or shepherd, that has been appropriated by many in the religious denominations to refer to the preacher. And that's very, very common. In fact, I would say I get probably 3 or 4 phone calls a week at the least here at the building, asking if I am the pastor, and I just explain to them, no, I'm the preacher or a preacher, and we distinguish between that, and it's not very helpful normally. They just want to sell you something. So when you make it clear that you're not interested in buying whatever they're selling, they're ready to get off the phone and go on to someone else. But it is interesting that it's characteristically the term pastor is used for an evangelist or a preacher. Whereas in the scripture, there is a very clear practice of designating the office of elder or bishop or pastor as being that office of oversight in the local church. And it's clearly established. We talked about the qualifications that are necessary. We talked about the plurality of elders that were appointed in each place. But having done that, we want to spend a little bit of time this morning discussing the actual admonition that is given in 1 Peter chapter 5 that are found in verses 2 through 3. And so the admonition that is given by the Apostle Peter, who identifies himself as a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ and a partaker of the glory that will be revealed. He says in verse 2, shepherd the flock of God which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion, but willingly, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly, nor as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that does not fade away. And we didn't have time to go into and discuss these three not but statements that are given in the text, but I do want to spend just a few moments doing so today. You'll notice the three statements. First of all, not by compulsion, but willingly. Not for dishonest gain, but eagerly. Not as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples. So the not but explanation does a very good job, construct there, does a very good job of explaining the nature of the oversight. Now, we do not wish to deny the fact that elders have authority. I made a point, and I think I alluded to this at the end of our time together last week. Made a point in a religious discussion that I had that any office that is appointed by God has intrinsic within it the authority to fulfill the duties of that office. Kind of a logical thing. It's something that's fairly obvious, but something that actually is denied. It's kind of a peculiar illogical position, but individuals deny that there is authority that resides in the office of elder. What the Apostle Peter here is doing is explaining possible abuses of that authority, possible inappropriate actions that one who serves as an elder may take, and gives the right and proper conduct of men who would serve in that capacity. So it's not to deny the fact that authority exists. It denies that authority is dictatorial in nature, denies that it is arbitrary in nature, denies that it allows men to elevate themselves to positions that that they determine or establish as proper, and instead limits it in accord with what God's will has to say. So looking at those three admonitions, the first one is that they are not to serve by compulsion, but willingly. The desire for the office is something that is extremely important. And there, again, are some logical reasons for this. When you have someone who is willing to serve, someone who desires to serve in a particular activity or position, then you have one who will have, as an outgrowth of that, a dedication and an interest, an individual who will be active in the work, whereas if you have one who is compelled to serve, resentment could possibly be there, apathy could be present, disinterested attitude could be there. So what Peter's saying here is you don't want men in the office who are serving because they have to, or because they feel that they have to. You want individuals who are there because they want to be in that office. Now, the importance of this, let me just give you a parallel. There are individuals who become parents, not willingly. That's almost a misnomer because of the fact that it's an act of will to involve in such activity. But it is as a consequence, for example, of promiscuity or something along those lines. And they, as a result of that, do not want a child, but the child is thrust upon them. So what is their reaction to it? Now, it may be that they gladly receive that and grow as a person, but often you'll have neglect and abuse and an apathy that's present because the child is unwanted. We even have that phrase that's commonly stated about unwanted children. You don't want a parent, or let's put it this way, a child will not thrive with a parent who is disinterested, who is serving as a parent because they're compelled to, because they have to. You want a parent who wants to be a mom or wants to be a dad, to be the parent of the child. And because you recognize all of the dangers and the problems that are inherent in the individual who does so because they're compelled. A second illustration along those lines would be the difference between conscripts, or those who are drafted in an army, and you have an all-volunteer army. And there is those arguments that are made. Individuals who are there, not because they want to be there, but because the government said they had to be, as contrasted with someone who makes military service his focus and desire and does so willingly. So we see those kinds of contrasts in a lot of different scenarios and different circumstances. It makes sense that an individual who is serving as an elder needs to be one who is truly willing and desirous of the position. A man who desires the work of the office of an elder is desiring a good thing. And by the way, an individual who desires it is an individual who should be applauded. He is one who should be encouraged. And we as a congregation ought to strive to develop men to serve in that capacity. Now, again, why? Why do you want to serve? I think maybe that's tied up in the other not but statements that we can discuss. But the fact of desiring the office is a positive thing. It's something that we would hope men would seek, because we need elders. But we certainly don't want a man who is serving in that capacity because he feels compelled to. And it's not something that he desires, because that's problematic in that regard. Now, the question I have for you, and we can discuss this and ask, make any comments that you want, but the question that I have are, in what way can an individual be compelled? Not by compulsion. In other words, what would lead an individual to be made to serve as an elder? I don't know of any situation where you put a gun to his head and say, "You serve or else," anything like that. But there has to be some circumstance or situation where a man will be compelled to serve that we need to perhaps delineate and talk about a little bit. Yes, Dennis?
The thing that comes to my mind is in a case where an elder is passed away and leaves one elder in the congregation. And now we feel a constraint to replace this elder. And so someone might not have been, maybe holding back a little bit from serving, and now they feel compelled to serve in order to keep the eldership functioning.
Okay, that's a good example. Now, and that could bring up one of these problems with a compulsion to leave. One of the things that comes to mind in a situation like that is a man serving who's not qualified, who doesn't have those qualifications in order to have that. In fact, I've heard of congregations doing just that. There are men who are lacking in a particular qualification or another, and yet there is that very real need for elders, and so the congregation feels that it's so important to have a man serving or men serving that they're willing to overlook inadequacies so that a man might be appointed. And it may be that in a situation like that, as a man is drafted, he may feel those same things, that I'm really not qualified, but there is that need for leadership, so as a result of that, I'll allow myself to be drafted into this service. But when you have that situation, again, you either have the primary thing that I pointed out, which is an unwillingness that might lead to problems, resentment, apathy, different things like that, or else an individual who is, because of a lack of qualifications or a lack of experience, can actually make decisions and leadership mistakes that can cause problems and be destructive to the church.
Well, Paul tells Timothy, the man desires to live the office of an elder, he desires good work. Paul told Titus, appoint elders in every city. He seems to have been under constraint. These are new congregations, obviously, and he needs to go out and establish leadership in those places. If a man is otherwise fully qualified to be an elder, he not desire the office? That raises an interesting question. Let's just say, well, if he doesn't desire the office, does that mean he's not qualified?
Well, I think that in a sense, though it's not in the list of qualifications per se in Timothy or Titus, that the desiring of the work would be a qualification of the work, is because it would be indicated here in 1 Peter chapter 5. We don't normally go to 1 Peter 5 to establish qualifications for the eldership, because there are two different lists that are given. But if an admonition is given by Peter, do not serve because you feel compelled to serve, then an individual who does not desire the work, certainly a man who's not qualified.
So,
be disqualifying himself because of that lack. Ron, did you have something?
One of the greatest compulsions that we have is ego. And that drives us to be all the wrong.
Sir. Yeah, it's the pride aspect of this is something that I want to touch on. I'd like to go to Philippians 2 in just a moment and enlarge upon that a little bit as we get into the others as well. Yes, Josh.
When you get into the idea of compulsion, office of elder or bishop is an office of, like you said, leadership. But when you get into compulsion, you're no longer leading, you're being led.
Okay. Yeah, in a sense, yeah, you were exactly right about that. And by the way, when we talk about this, the question always arises, shouldn't every man desire to be an elder? As if, in the sense that being an elder is kind of a pinnacle of the expression of your Christian faith. And I think that that's a mistake to look at it that way. We certainly need elders. We certainly need to develop men to serve in that capacity. But there is that recognition that not all have the same talents and maybe the same makeup. And I can perceive of a man who is, and let's set aside the domestic qualifications that might exclude an individual not having children or not being married, something along those lines, and just make note of those things that are with regard to character. I can imagine an individual because of his makeup or his personality who can be a mature Christian, a faithful Christian, an energetic Christian, a zealous man, and still not desire the office. And I think that while we certainly need to encourage all men to aspire to that position, and hope that as their spiritual character and their circumstances of life mature and grow, they reach that point where they can serve. I do not believe that it's appropriate for us to indicate that a man who is not deserving that office is in some way not being faithful to God. And I see that as an opposite extreme that sometimes is reached. And because not all have that makeup. And there are some very specific abilities that an elder has that not all men have, though they may be very faithful and diligent Christians. And so again, this idea not to serve by compulsion could have a kind of a double-edged admonition, though it is directed primarily to the individual. We should not be guilty as a congregation to seek to compel a man who is either not qualified or not desirous of the. In other words, let's not guilt him into the office in that regard. Because again, this is an indication of something that would be destructive to the group if it were to happen. And just getting someone in there is not better than not having anyone at all. We may think so, but God does not. He's made very clear that He doesn't. So what we want are men who are both qualified and desirous of the work and to serve in that capacity. Yes, sir.
I agree with the statement. I think there are men who have all the qualifications, are people who have a lot of great work for the church, but do not want the leadership responsibility. I think we have to want that leadership responsibility. We don't want the decision maker to encourage.
Anybody else? Yes, please. The work is not for all men, and it may be circumstances of life that would preclude one being able to fulfill his duty as an elder. Because again, it is a very weighty responsibility that is there. Whatever the reason might be, while we should be zealous in encouraging men to serve in that capacity, we should not be overly critical of individuals who feel that they're not capable of serving because of this very reason. We don't want to have men in the office that are compelled to be there.
We're talking about compulsion from the congregation, but I think another compulsion might be from the man's family. Maybe he's particularly have a desire to do it, but if his wife is pushing him to do that, maybe he's going to do that to please his wife or his parents or kids or that's inappropriate.
And especially with regard to the wife. So might I make a statement that I think is obviously true, nevertheless it is problematic in many churches. There is no office in the church that goes by the name elder's wife. when you say elder's wife, you're referring to a relationship that the woman has with the man, not with the church. Okay, so there are two reasons for this. And by the way, the same thing is true with regard to preacher's wife. And you see that same kind of standard that is set up. Now, it's not saying that that it's okay for an elder's wife to be less than she should be, or a preacher's wife to be less than she should be. But sometimes churches, start from one side first, and we'll go to the other. Sometimes churches can put responsibilities on women. Number one, that they don't have, hold them to a different standard than other women in the congregation, which is inappropriate, and try to make that distinction. In fact, in a sense, that distinction is inappropriate with regard to the men as well. I mean, there is an office that is held by men who serve as elders and preachers, and the office that they hold, and others in the church. But the fact is, the responsibilities that are not intrinsic to that specific office, the primary responsibilities that we have as Christians are equal responsibilities that we all have. And it is inappropriate to say, okay, this individual should be treated differently, or more expected of them, or held to a different standard because it is the wife of an elder or wife of a preacher. And I have more to do with that. Has more to do with the idea of the gossip that sometimes comes, or social aspects, things like that. Now the second thing with regard to that is that there are some women who interfere in the affairs of oversight, utilizing their influence as wives over the husbands who are serving as elders, and that would be likewise inappropriate. It's an obvious thing, again, that you have the qualifications of a man to serve in the capacity of oversight, and so for any Christian to seek to make decisions for the church or insert themselves with regard to the oversight capacity of the office, whether by influence or pressure, that would be likewise inappropriate. So just kind of make that distinction, that they are the wives of the elders, but they aren't elders' wives in the sense of an office.
I thought it was an elder's wife. Well, I mean, that was a part of what from her, and the caution that you have to take to not be seen as someone who's trying to do that. I know when my kids were younger, they'd say, well, what's going on? Bring that down to me. I said, A, I don't know. B, if I did know, I wouldn't tell you. But there, you have to be very cautious of that. Yes, I'm married to him, and yes, I have an influence as a wife, but I don't have an influence in the ruling of the church.
Good. Yeah. So that's something to keep in mind as well. Kind of off the subject of the specific context, but it's nevertheless important point.
If you will, I have a question coming from an ignorant view. And the question is, let's say, doing a marvelous job for 10 years as an elder, and then all of a sudden he becomes a widower. Does him being a widower disqualify him, or take away from his title, or whatever? Or does he mean?
That's a very interesting question, Kyle, and you say that you speak from ignorance. I understand what you're saying, but you have asked a question that brethren have been divided over in their thinking for as long as I've been around, and I'm sure long before me. That's a very difficult question to answer. And my primary statement would be that the answer that you would give, I'm not going to be dogmatic about this at all, but the answer that you would give would center with regard to your view of qualifications. There are two different possibilities in this regard. One is that a qualification is a particular prerequisite to service in the office. And if at any point in time a circumstance changes where that prerequisite to the office is no longer present, then the individual would have to step down. in that situation you would have, and primarily this revolves around the domestic qualifications that are given in both the epistles. So you would have a man who is no longer married to one wife, which is a qualification of the office, would have to step down because he's no longer the husband of one wife. The other view of this is that the qualifications are to establish in the office a man who is capable of doing the work of oversight. Now, we don't have the right in any way to say, well, okay, he doesn't have these, but I think he'll do good anyway. So it would be inappropriate ever to appoint a man who is not qualified in that way. But you bring out a point here that an individual has been the husband of one wife, who's qualified to serve, he's been serving and has served admirably, so he is now proven as a servant of God, who is capable of exercising oversight. And then if his domestic circumstances change, and the primary situation would be the loss of a wife, then unless that would exclude him from having the ability to carry on the work or continue in the work, he would not be disqualified from service. So rather than a prerequisite for the continued holding of the office, it would instead be a prerequisite to the obtaining of the office, so that men who are capable will be serving. A man who's shown his capability, then he could remain. That would be, again, only in so much as he could continue. Some would take the position that if he's no longer the husband of one wife, doesn't have a wife, then he could no longer serve. In the sense of couldn't continue in that work. And I don't know of any work that is specific to the office of oversight that would be impacted to the extent he could no longer do it. The thing that comes up is hospitality, being hospitable. But I can see a bachelor being hospitable even after his wife has passed away. So I don't know that there's any specific work. And so I'm going to answer that question by saying I have a particular view that I hold, but I don't know if it is entirely correct. And so I prefer not to say dogmatically one way or the other. And maybe that some others might have a view that would differ with me in that regard. My view is, but I don't want to, it was that a man could continue to serve, but I don't know that everyone would agree with that.
I just have a 10-second comment. Mm-hmm. The prerequisite that he outlook of life.
Perspective, yes. Sure.
Perspective. Sure. And it would make him a different man that way.
Oh, certainly. Very much so. Yeah. And that's the reason why someone might say, well, I think that a bachelor could do a good job of oversight. Well, maybe so. But God wants a particular kind of man serving in that office, and that is the one who has a wife, again, to be appointed to that office. And not only a wife, but also children as well, who are believing. So, again, this is something that a few guidelines to keep in mind. Recognizing the brethren have come down on either side, depending on their view, that there are differences. One of the things that a man who serves as an elder must have is the backing of the congregation. You can't lead a group that is unwilling to follow you. So that also will have an impact upon it. But I do know, let's put it this way, I know of some congregations where a widowed man continues to serve as an elder and the congregation is fine with it if he does it. And I know of congregations that when a man became a widower, that he was asked to or felt compelled to step down and could not continue to serve because of the conscientious objections that some of the congregation might have. So both of us have been present.
Yeah, I just think it's a similar situation as the qualification for having believing children. If your children get to be 35, 40 years old and fall away, where does that put the elder? It's the same situation.
And some think that he would have to step down, some believe that he wouldn't, and there are different congregations that both of those things apply. And I've got my view about that too, that some probably here would disagree with. So, yes, Dick.
Well, along that line, with Eli and his children, they were married, but his children weren't doing right. And Eli paid the consequence for that.
He did not restrain them.
It'd be the same thing if Eli and Alder, one of their children, fall away. They have two or three or four children. One of them is unfaithful. He should be signed.
Yeah. That's a little different situation because Eli had his children had an office, and he was he had a responsibility.
In that situation as well, the reason, or one of the reasons why they were acting as they were, is because of his failure as a father. He did not restrain them. Yes, Ron.
Had to throw a finger on fire and then try to put it out.
At least try to put it out if you're going to do it.
One of the qualifications is the man not giving him the wine. What if later on he does give him the wine? Is he still qualified?
No.
You see? So I think what you have here is those things over which you have control and those things over which you have no control. You have no control over wife dying. You have no control over children departing after they've gone over and departed the house. So under those circumstances, I think decisions have to be different.
All right. Making a distinction there. Okay. I don't want to become too bogged down with regard to this. It perhaps would be good for us. It's been a while since we've had a study of Timothy and Titus dealing with the specific qualifications. But again, understanding this, that there are men and women, faithful Christians, on both sides of that question that are troubled by it and come to different conclusions. So that if we did have a study like this, at the end of it, there would still maybe possibly be differences between us in that regard. I'm very pleased with the fact of the men that we have serving in that capacity as members of this congregation, in contrast to some of the problems that perhaps exist in others. With that in mind, let's continue on with the second admonition that is given after the statement is made not to serve by compulsion but willingly. The second one is not for dishonest gain, but eagerly. Okay, so willingness is one thing there, but there is a kind of an elevation in that of eager service. Again, indicating, but the contrast with the eager service that is given here is the dishonest gain. And by the way, individuals can be very eager to serve as elders for the purpose of getting dishonest gain. When we talk about dishonest gain and the admonition here, it would be, hey, how can gain come? How can a person dishonestly gain from the position of elder? There are a lot of ways. It's actually possible for men to gain monetarily as a result of service as elders. They can use the influences that they have over others in the congregation to utilize for their own purpose. It would be a dishonest thing to do so, but pressure could be brought to bear, or even friendships that are developed as such could be utilized for the purpose of gain. That regard. I'll just give you an example. An objection is a congregation in Midland, Texas that I was talking to. It's been a number of years ago. I don't remember who I was talking to, but they were at one time members of that congregation, and they said they left. I asked them, why did they leave? They said because all that was being talked about in the foyer before and after services was business. There were a lot of businessmen and individuals who were fairly well off, and they were using, this is a big, very large congregation, a lot of influential people that were members there, and they were utilizing that as a means of furthering their business or civic goals. Politics and business were being perpetrated in the lobby, kind of like in the temple, when the temple was being used for merchandise. That type of thing would certainly be inappropriate. But there are other things. Some people they don't care too much for money, but they do care for position, prestige, and power. And one of the things to keep in mind as you look at this, especially as you get to the final admonition, is that the office of an elder there again is intrinsic in that office, because it is an office of oversight. There is authority. Decisions have to be made and guidance given to a particular congregation. And whenever there is authority, there is the potential of abuse of that authority. And I, you know, when I see those kinds of admonitions given, what always comes to my mind is the husband-wife relationship. As given, for example, the instructions in Ephesians chapter 5, where wives are told to submit to their husbands, but husbands are told to love their wives, as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. Now, no one would deny the authority of Jesus Christ over the church, as head of the church, but there was nothing in Jesus with regard to the relationship he sustains with us that makes him a tyrant, makes him an abuser of his position or his power. When Christ came, he did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. He was the ultimate servant, the Son of God, and the Son of Man. And as a result of that, he serves as a wonderful example to us. And you look here, the Apostle Paul, or Peter, excuse me, he is exhorting elders as a fellow elder, and then stated as they diligently apply themselves to this service, that when the chief shepherd appears, which has reference, of course, to Jesus Christ again, you'll receive the crown of glory. And so, either in both of these two things, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly, nor as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples, there is, again, this idea of selfishness. That's what goes behind the person who is seeking the office and serving in the office for the purpose of gaining something, getting something, which, again, the use of the office of elder in order to gain or get is in itself a dishonest thing. It's not being transparent. It's a person is hiding a motive that is impure and inappropriate. And so it's selfishness is what's under consideration. Selfishness that leads to abuse. And the selfless servant, if he is in that position of authority and he keeps himself pure with regard to selflessness and humility, the idea of dishonest gain would be something that would be abhorrent to him. The idea of being dictatorial, lording it over those entrusted to him, would be something that would be completely unacceptable. Because it would not, it'd be against his nature because of who he is. And so the idea here is selflessness and humility. And I didn't, we didn't read it in Philippians chapter 2, but I would remind you of the second chapter of Philippians, as he calls individuals not to look out for their own interest only, but also the interest of others, and to esteem others more highly than you esteem yourself. That type of selflessness and humility was characteristic of Jesus Christ, and it certainly should be for us as well.
The relationship between elder and congregation is so clearly defined in the word shepherd. Because if you think about the role of the sheep or the shepherd, Jesus said, "My sheep hear my voice, they obey my voice." And yet the shepherd's role toward the sheep, he was screaming at them, he was ordering them, he leads them, he guides them.
Yeah, it's probably the best of the three words. Of course, elder has reference to age. Overseer, I think, has reference to the office itself and the fact that they're the authority of the office. But what does an elder do? He feeds, he guides, and he protects. And in that idea of feeding, guiding, and protection that comes with that idea of being a shepherd or a pastor, we see that in the tenderness of relationship and the demeanor that he would hold as he's serving as an elder. So yeah, that's the best one. Yeah. And yeah, certainly. And you can see that, of course, again in the illustration when you consider the actions of a real shepherd over a real sheep. And not the hireling, but the individual, the sheep are his, and his protection, his care and concern for them, and his willingness again to put himself in harm's way for their sakes. Of course, as we look at Jesus as the ultimate example of that, even to die and shed his blood that our sins might be taken away, then again you see something of the responsibility as you serve as an overseer among God's people. Okay? So those are the three admonitions. The third one that we haven't talked about in big detail, but we've alluded to is not as being lords over those entrusted to you. Now the term lord, again, is one that is indicative of authority. Literal rendering of that term, if you have a definition in your center column, mentions master, a master. When Jesus says, "All authority has been given to me," he is our master. Okay, that's a little bit different than an individual serving as an overseer. Now, again, passages like this are sometimes utilized to say that elders have no authority in the church, and the idea here of serving as an example would mean that they are limited in their capacity as elders simply to being good examples. And again, there's something extremely illogical about that. The idea that, okay, we're going to appoint men to a particular position. We're going to identify men who are in that particular position. We're going to title these men as pastors, overseers, and elders. And then these men, all they are an example that we're to look to. And how our decision is going to be made in the congregation. Every man does what's right in his own eyes, or we all just have a democratically called assembly and all vote on it. You know, these are the kinds of things that actually being advocated in the religious world and in the church as well. And it's an illogical thing. So what's behind that? And my statement would be two things. Number one, you have had in the past, or individuals have been part of, congregations where the elders were lording it over the flock. And believe me, that's happened and can happen. And it's not uncommon, because anytime you have men who are either unqualified or who are serving by compulsion or serving for dishonest gain, you have individuals who can indeed be dictatorial in their actions and destructive to God's people. So there is a problem. And often what will happen when you have a situation like that is there will be an extreme reaction to it, to where if you've been around dictatorial elders and you say that's not the way to go, then the next extreme is the pendulum swings, is to say we want to be around people who have no authority at all and be able to make determinations for ourselves and so forth. The second problem is that in our society today, the concept of authority is not well received on any level. Police officers are disrespected. Magistrates are ridiculed. The laws of the land are flouted, and in the church as well. Individuals do not want to have anyone telling them what they should be doing, or how to act, or how to conduct themselves. The very concept that anyone would have the audacity to come and to admonish them if they were in sin is something that is unacceptable to some. And so the problem can be from the other direction as well. It's not so much that men are acting despotically or acting as lords over the flock, which of course we're constrained from doing. No man can do so. But it's simply a matter of any kind of instruction, admonition, limitation, at all. Correction is something that is unacceptable to some. And so that's an opposite extreme. And when you have a husband who does not love his wife, then the concept of headship and submission is something that is very destructive. When you have a woman who is unwilling to submit to the headship of her husband, then you have likewise a problematic situation that leads to heartache. When you have a woman who submits to her husband and a man who loves his wife, boy, it works well. And the same thing could be said as we parallel that to the church. If you have a congregation, as we're admonished in Hebrews chapter 13, who submit to oversight and do so willingly, and recognize that God will hold them accountable for their behavior and demeanor. And you have likewise men who are following these admonitions in this particular text, and not being lords or despots or masters over the flock, then you've got a good situation. But if you have either of those other two things, where either those who are in the congregation are unwilling to submit to those who legitimately have oversight, or else you have men in capacity of oversight who are doing so because they're compelled or for dishonest gain or as being lords over the flock, then you've got a problem. Okay? So, one of the things to do is kind of think of it as to where are you? Are you one who's in a position? And this is with regard to any relationship. Parent-child, civil situations where you're a citizen or one who's in authority over the citizenship, husband-wife, elders in the flock, you and Christ. One of two things is true. Either I am in a position of authority and oversight, or I'm not. I'm in a position where I'm to submit. And when admonitions are given, it's inappropriate for me to say to the person on the other side of the relationship, see, that's what you need to do. Instead, what I need to do is figure out which side of that relationship I'm supposed to be on and say, okay, this is what I am responsible for. And that's very much more effective and helpful than the other. We take care of ourselves, it has a tendency to accomplish much more than trying to tell others as we ignore ourselves. What's the statement about taking the beam out of your own eye before you deal with the speck in another's? Yes, brother.
I have one thing to say, kind of relate back to this first. No, but I think there's kind of a spectrum of some desire to be an elder. There may be some that 8 years old, they want to be an elder. Maybe some just no way they're going to do it ever. Somewhere in between, there's in between. But the make love be men qualified to be elders, they've never really made it their life's goal. But with some encouragement, and seeing that it is a worthwhile goal. And I don't see anything wrong with encouraging somebody to be an elder. And in the end, they have to have a willingness. The difference between being compelled and being encouraged. It may be that they just need somebody to help them think about it a little bit, that this is a work that they do, they'd be good at it, they would be benefited.
That's certainly true, because we definitely need them. We need more men serving in that capacity. Thank you very much for your kind attention today. We'll pick up with verse 5 next time.